Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
It is another Thursday evening. This is LA Talk Radio. You are listening to The Writer's Block, and I am Jim Christina, your host. In the studio tonight with the wonderfully charming Bobby Jean Bell.
Good to be back.
It is great to have you in the studio with me again. I just love it when you're here. We have a really good show lined up for you tonight. Let's get started pretty quick. We are going to say the Writer's Block is brought to you by Black Dog Publishing. Nice folks at Black Dog. They're for new writers that can finish a story or want to figure out how to do it or how to get it published, where to go to get an agent. And that's what we do. Give us a call. The number there is 805-795-3165, and we can help you walk it through. And by
Target Freight Management.
There you go.
Since 2009, Target Freight has had a full truckload service that's the best in the industry. They go to great lengths to secure the most competitive rates possible. TFM also provides unmatched customer support from their dedicated truckload division. In an effort to streamline their customers' overall shipping efficiency, TFM provides real-time updates on all lanes. Call TFM today at 1-844-653-7789 and tell them you heard this on The Writer's Block, and they'll have a little something extra for you. And if you are an LTL shipper, we know you are looking for the best rates with the least hassle. Call Target Freight Management. Their customized transportation management system is just the ticket to getting your freight moved your way. Call Target Freight Management today at 1-888-653-1323 or go to www.targetfmi.com on the web for both truckload and LTL. Call today. You won't be disappointed.
Nope. And last but certainly not least, Out West is your online source for top brands that are a reflection of the equestrian and Western lifestyles. Shop for unique and distinctive apparel, boots, hats, fashion, accessories, home decor, books, music, and general merchandise. National brands include the Scully Leather Company, Rock Mount Ranchwear, Dan Post Boots, and American West Handbags, just to name a few. Shop online at www.scvoutwest.com. And if you enter code WB100, you'll receive $10 off your order. Call toll-free 877-340-9378 or locally 661-347-9700.
There we go.
Okay. That out of the way. Now everybody's been happy. Everybody's been paid. Our guest tonight is a writer from Texas, and this is her brief bio. Rosa Walston Latimer is an author, playwright, and an award-winning photographer. She has written for national and regional magazines and newspapers and was a news editor of a print and online newspaper and supervising director of a nationally syndicated television program. I had no idea. That I want to ask about.
Mm-hmm.
The story of her Harvey girl grandmother sparked her interest in preserving women's history and inspired her to write her first book, Harvey Houses of Texas. Historic hospitality from the Gulf Coast to the Panhandle, followed by Harvey Houses of New Mexico and Harvey Houses of Kansas, all published by the History Press. Harvey Houses of Kansas received a notable Kansas Book Award in 2016, and Harvey Houses of Texas was nominated for a Texas Christian University Texas Book Award. Rosa has just signed a contract for Harvey Houses of Arizona that will be released in History Press in fall of 2017. Would you please welcome to the Writer's Block Rosa Latimer? Rosa, are you with us?
Welcome.
I'm here, yes.
Well,
good
you
evening.
Know, well, good evening. You know, it's a good thing that you actually write your own bios, because that's what we read. So we tell everybody, if you lied, your friends are going to know.
They're going to know. Yes. No, it's all true.
Oh, good. You know, I'm really, it's very interesting having you on the show, mostly because my wife's mother worked at a Harvey's restaurant in Union Station, Kansas City, Missouri. And she was a cashier there. And there was a couple things that was notably different. Her uniform was different than that of the waitresses. In that, I guess the cashiers, even the newspaper cashiers, could pretty much wear what they wanted.
And that all changed from the beginning of the restaurant.
Right.
Things were very strict in the early days, but yes, there were lots of changes as the years went by and the skirts got shorter.
Well, I'm sure they did.
And that was 1933,
To 1930s. I think she worked there until 1937,
right.
She was married. Oh. So, but an interesting story about that is that in June of 1933, there was a happenstance at the Union Station in Kansas City, Missouri, in which it's now called the Kansas City Massacre, where Pretty Boy Floyd and a bunch of his cronies tried to get a friend of theirs away from the FBI. There was a big shootout, and of course, several FBI agents died, and it was just a mess. My wife's mother was not able to be there. She was late getting to work because the manager of the place was supposed to pick her up, and he was late picking her up. So they drove into the parking lot to an absolute mess.
Oh, and I'm sure they were shocked.
Oh, yeah. Well, I would well imagine, because, you know, news didn't travel that fast back in 1933. So, anyway.
Well, I was in Kansas City last September. And I did a presentation for the National Archives there in Kansas City. And one of their volunteers took me to Union Station and actually showed me holes in the wall.
Oh, yeah.
Bullets hit the wall.
Oh, yeah. It was pretty
quite
nasty, I guess. Yeah, it's quite a happening going on there in old Kansas City.
Wow.
So I read your book, The Harvey Houses of Kansas, and I'm enthralled.
And I read Texas.
And you read Texas.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Well, so great.
Well, you send books, we read them. That's the way it is. We never talk to an author on the fly because it makes you look stupid in the long run.
No. And half of the fun of talking to authors is having the chance to have read what they've written.
Right.
Yeah. Well, sure.
Yeah. You know, you don't write it to sit on a shelf.
What'd you think about it?
I loved the Kansas one, mostly because you included the history of the Harvey Houses period with it, and Fred Harvey and the way it started, mm-hmm. and how he made the deal with Santa Fe Railroad, and it was just quite a fascinating story. And then to go through all the houses along the line and see how they were, and then find out that nobody wanted to go to Dodge City.
No.
I mean, that was like, if you were in trouble, you're going to Dodge City.
Yes, and that was even in the 30s. The Harvey girl, that's the story I told, she worked for the Fred Harvey Company for, I think, close to 40 years. And Dodge City was her shortest stay. She got out of there as quick as she could.
Well, I can't really say as I blame her.
Why don't you, Rosa, for those, you know, some folks might be familiar with the term Harvey Girl based on their experience watching a really fun musical years ago. Or, you know, they may, you know, it's a kind of an iconic name. But why don't you take a moment and give us a little bit of background on the Harvey Girl and the Harvey House, and then how you came upon this capturing your imagination.
Okay. Well, in 1876, Fred Harvey, who had come to the United States from England, struck a deal with the president of Santa Fe Railroad. Santa Fe was trying to expand west to California, and to help finance that, they needed to encourage passengers. And one of the biggest problems about traveling any distance was, how are you going to feed the people? Mm-hmm. And, of course, the train at that time stopped about every 100 miles. It was steam engine, so they had to stop and refuel. And when they would stop, there might be a saloon or there might not be anything, any place to get food. So Mr. Harvey told the president of Santa Fe that he would develop restaurants along the railroad, and that his food and his service would be so good that people would ride the train just to eat at a Harvey House, which is what he called his restaurants. And that was quite a vision, but it came true. Mm-hmm. And there are many stories of people who plan their trip along the Santa Fe Railroad to eat at Harvey houses and to stay at Harvey hotels. Mm-hmm. But in these small towns, of course, if there weren't even any places to eat, there were very few people available to work in the restaurants, and especially not to keep the high standards that Mr. Harvey had. So he ran ads in women's magazines in the Northeast and the Midwest, advertising for women, educated women of good character to come west. And if you responded to the ad, that you went to Kansas City and had a personal interview, and if they liked you, they gave you a train pass and sent you west to work in a Harvey House. And as these restaurants developed, and the Harvey girls, as they were called, their reputation spread because Mr. Harvey had living space for them on the second floor of the restaurant. They had curfews. They were expected to be ladies. And then he didn't have to advertise anymore because women wanted to take advantage of this employment opportunity at a time when, if a woman were going to work, she usually could only be either a nurse, a teacher, or a housekeeper and nanny. So these were great opportunities for the women. They made $17.50 a month. Their uniforms were provided, their laundry was done, and they were provided room and board.
And they worked seven.
It was the 24/7 food service. Mm-hmm. So they worked shifts, which, of course, being a good businessman, that's why Mr. Harvey wanted them to live on the premises.
Oh, absolutely.
So they were never late to work. And, or if they were, he could go knock on their door. His manager would, of course. So it was a great adventure for some of the women. For many of the women, it was the first time they'd been further than walking distance from their farm. And I've interviewed quite a few Harvey girls, read letters that they wrote home to their families. And this is a great part of women's history in our country. And I felt that it has not been told as to the extent that it should be.
It was. I read the book, the one about the Texas, and I think one of the things that stood out for me, and maybe Jim for you too, was, you know, these Harvey houses were really all over the country. It's wonderful that you're writing about each region, but the training was so developed, and the consistency of behaviors as well as the look of the buildings, the interiors. And the food from the coffee, you know, famous for the coffee. He did things like you mentioned that pie, instead of being cut in slices of 6 to 8 pieces per pie, were four.
Yeah.
The consistency level of being able to train so many people across the country with such consistency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the day before computers, you know, there's telegraph, and we're keeping up with technologies that all goes along. But I was fascinating at the ability to keep the records, order the... I have to just say, from the Texas book, you say this fun report from 1907. In 1907, 300,000 pounds of butter were used, 500,000
yeah.
pounds of ham. You give wonderful 6,480,000 eggs. You know, in 1907, when they're still not probably as fully flung as, you know,
right.
as they become. And
right.
just the unification of process, it seemed to me to be kind of ahead of its time.
It way ahead of its time. And I need to say that actually, Mr. Harvey set all of this in motion. He could ship food and employees and supplies and laundry by train at no cost.
Right. Yeah, see, and that was perfect. Like, laundry goes on the train and comes back the next day done, you know?
He
knew how to take advantage of the train.
One Harvey girl told me that she just felt she was living in the lap of luxury because all she had to do was iron. Everything else was done.
Yeah, that was in this book that you quoted her in Kansas, that all she had to do was iron. Everything was done.
But Mr. Harvey actually died in 1901.
Right.
But he had set everything in motion, and his oldest son, Ford Harvey, came in and just took over, and everything continued.
That's amazing.
In the same way.
And no change.
I do think part of the reason that they could accomplish this was the time period, because people were so proud to have these jobs, and they wanted to be to live up to his standards and the standards of the company. And, you know, they just had a really strong work ethic.
Right. Well, in the 1870s, 1880s, even 1890s, $17 a month for a young woman was a lot of money.
And interesting, 1876, you and I as sort of armchair historians, there's so much that happens in 1876. It's like a turning point, you know, for this country in so many ways. But you wonder, like, with the coming of the stagecoach, why wasn't anybody thinking, you know, they have to change the horses out every
20 miles.
Yeah. Why don't why weren't we having the same kind of idea, you know?
Well, I think they tried.
because passengers had that same kind of challenge.
Right.
You know,
yes, they did.
By stage.
Uh-huh.
So,
well, you know,
a lot of
stage stations used to nail their plates to the tables. And then they would serve the steward or whatever they would serve. And then when the passengers got back on the train, they'd take a bucket and just wash everything out with a mop and then rinse it. And that was done. And
well,
then wait for the next
people.
Well,
that was not the Harvey way.
No, that was not. You know, it amazed me some of the tidbits that you picked up.
That was so fun.
And the fact that these women did, as Bobby mentioned, went through so much training.
Amazing.
Yeah. And the way that they knew what customers wanted to drink by the way they set the coffee cups.
Oh, that was great. Yeah, tell us.
Go through that, would you? Because that's actually very interesting.
How did you know as a Harvey girl?
About the cup code.
Yes.
Yeah, the cup code.
Well, the passengers would place their order on the train at a certain milestone outside, and their orders were telegraphed in to the next stop.
Right.
And that's how the restaurant knew what food to be ready for. And as soon as the passengers sat down, because the goal was to feed them in 20 minutes.
Right.
But if it went past 20 minutes, the train always waited for them. And so the first Harvey girl would come along to take a drink order. No Harvey girl could write down any order. The meal, you know, if someone from town came in to eat, they memorized the orders, they didn't write anything down. So the first Harvey girl would come by the table and ask what they wanted to drink. And she would place the cup in a certain position so that the drink girl, when she came along, she knew exactly what drink to give each guest. So,
That
is where it is believed that even today, if you sit at a table in a restaurant that already has the cup and saucer out, if you don't want coffee, you turn your cup upside down.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that was part of the cup code, like a cup upside down and the saucer meant, I believe it actually meant coffee then.
Yes.
And then if you place the cup kind of tilted at the edge of the saucer, half on the table, half on the saucer, that meant tea. And there were different positions that they would place the cup, and then the drink girl would know exactly what each guest wanted.
It's amazing.
Now, most of the restaurants, it looked like there was kind of a consistency, sort of a horseshoe shape, how the chairs were put out, and beautiful, you know, the starched white linen tablecloths. I mean, really, really elegant. But I think it seemed like they seat about 48 was the maximum at a time. or so?
Yes, and that would be at the lunch counter.
Right.
And then in most of the, if it was only a restaurant, then the dining room would be 8 to possibly a dozen mm-hmm. tables that seated 4. But yes, the counters, that was, I think the largest one that I can remember was like 50 or 52.
Okay, right. So a train coming in could certainly have a lot more passengers than what the restaurant could accommodate. So was it kind of the obviously you had to be, you know, you had to be able to pay for your meal, but they would only take reservations for up to X number of tables and be one seating?
You know, I know that they did one seating, and I'm just not sure about the how many passengers would be on the trains, you know, at a time.
Right.
So, actually, that's a great question. I'm going to address that in this next book.
Well, I really wondered because, you know, I know we don't take the train often, but we do take the train occasionally to Albuquerque. And, you know, there was a dining car,
and
you would have to make a reservation. Or you can go down to kind of the snack car or just bring your own food. And I know there's, you know, lots of people on the train, but not everybody chooses to do those things.
Right.
And I thought, well, maybe it was the same way. You know, the first 48 of you that, you know, tell us what you want, you're going to get the seat.
Right.
And the rest of
right.
you, it's going to be up to your...
Well, I think a lot of people back then used to bring their own food on board.
And bring their
too.
Own food on right. board, yeah. Yeah.
Some could bring their own, you know, they bring their own food. I do know that at Harvey Houses at various times did have lunch boxes prepared.
Ah, right. See, and that would make sense.
So, and the way that came up is that during the Depression, there were men who were traveling looking for work would come to the back door of the Harvey House early in the morning. And the rule at the Harvey Houses were that you never carried food over to the next day.
Mm-hmm.
But the chef, the people in the kitchen would save the lunch boxes and put them out the back door so that these men could have a meal.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the lunch boxes maybe were pretty standard, and maybe some passengers chose that route. I'm sure it was less expensive.
Oh, I'm sure.
Although a full dinner evening meal would be $1.50 to $1.75,
and a lot of food. And then then my other thought was, as I thought about the people getting off the train to eat, there was always local business. People wanted to come and, you know, enjoy eating there. And I wondered if it was sort of stated that we know trains will be coming in at whatever time the train would be coming, and they wouldn't have enough seats to, you know, handle local
mm-hmm.
folks, and local folks would know, oh, you better get there at 3, you know, to get between the 1 o'clock and the 4 o'clock train.
I think you're right, Bobby. The local people knew when to come, and a lot of the, of course, the Santa Fe employees also ate in the Harvey Houses. And they were usually the best restaurant for the local people as well, as you mentioned.
Right.
So.
Well, they had both a dining room and a lunch counter.
That's right. There's
in most
of them, yes.
They did.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes. And the food, and then they had a pie counter.
Yeah, I know.
A separate pie counter, which is amazing.
And the newsstand, there's a wonderful picture in the Texas book near the end. There's a fabulous photo of a newsstand. I'm actually going to hand the book to my husband to show him this. That was so smart. There was really a great diversification of income streams, having the newsstand, and because of that it's connected to the train, being able to have newspapers from you know, all over the country.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And Lucky Strikes were... prominently displayed there.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And in some locations
in the green label,
yeah.
Yes. And in Texas, for instance, there were 16 Harvey restaurants or restaurants and hotels. But there were two, Paris, Texas, and Beaumont, Texas, only had a Harvey newsstand. But it was so popular, as you mentioned, because of the newspapers, and they could actually guide what books were going to be bestsellers by stocking them in their newsstands.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole the whole big picture of their business plan and the way they really used every opportunity to provide goods and services to train passengers is just a great American story.
I think probably for its time, it's probably the most successful business that we had in this country at the time.
It seems like it.
Yeah.
It does.
I mean,
like
it was
it?
So together. And up to the time when it finally sold the last one off at the Grand Canyon,
I was going to ask about...
It was
about,
all run yeah, the same.
The Grand Canyon,
still.
That's uh-huh. such a great story. And March being Women's History Month, they have a wonderful relationship with Mary Coulter.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, can you touch a little bit about that?
Well, again, the Fred Harvey Company, and actually she was... As I understand it, she was hired by Fred Harvey, but then he soon died. And she continued with the company for many, many years and designed, I'm not sure how much of El Tovar at Grand Canyon, but Bright Angel Lodge was definitely her building. La Fonda in Santa Fe, New Mexico. A lot of her design work on the interior of that building, and it's wonderful because these buildings have been preserved and you can still see her work. But it was very unusual, first of all, for a woman to be an architect in this time period, and then to have such a far-reaching job and responsibility with the Fred Harvey Company mm-hmm. through these states.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if you're of a certain age, you remember the Southwest decor of the 1980s, was it?
Absolutely.
And she was kind of the mother of Southwest mm-hmm. decor.
Yep.
It began in Albuquerque.
Yep.
She forged a very respectful, productive relationship with the Native Americans and began to sell their products. And there's an interview with a man from the reservation in the New Mexico book, Harvey Houses of New Mexico, and he said that the Fred Harvey people taught their women the products to make. In other words, instead of weaving something that would be a throw on a bed, make it a little heavier and it'll be a rug. So they worked with them and taught them how to make their products more appealing to mm-hmm. travelers.
Well, it makes more sense than anything else.
Yes, yes.
Okay, we're gonna switch gears here a little bit, and we're gonna ask
okay.
you about your writing process.
Okay.
You apparently you write every day.
No, I don't. But in a week's time, I write more days than not.
Ah.
I guess is the best way to explain it. There are some days that I just don't have what it takes to be productive, and I'm not a person who can just sit there and wait until, you know, just kind of write and delete and write and delete. That's very frustrating to me. So I take days where I just think about where I am in my writing and,
mm-hmm.
and, that's what I call it, is my think time. And,
sure.
I may work on another project that's less demanding or something and just give myself a rest.
There you go. The name of this show is The Writer's Block. Have you ever gotten writer's block, or do you have it? Or
If I've had it, it's been very short-lived. That's kind of part of my process. And as I said, if I just don't think I can put much on the page, then I usually choose to do something else. And then on the days when I do write, I mm-hmm. may write 12 or 14 hours.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Now, this is when I have a deadline, of course, you mm-hmm. just have to, then you have to just sit and
right.
do it.
Right. Yeah, then you have to do it.
To do these books, you obviously had to do, you know, tremendous research, did a lot of interviewing and gathering of all kinds of documents. I noticed that you have your private collection, the Rosa Walston Latimer collection, is at the Portal to Texas History. And I went to that Portal to Texas History, and oh my goodness, you could spend your life there.
Isn't it wonderful?
Oh, what a resource for authors who are writing, you know, anything about Texas. How did you house your collection, or did you scan everything that you have so they have access to it? Or tell us a little bit about that.
Well, a representative from and that portals to Texas history is through the University of North Texas in Denton, Texas. And a representative from the school was here in our little library. I mean, I live in Post, Texas, and we're 3,700 people. And in Texas, it's located just below the Panhandle. Okay. So we're not in Central Texas, but so I'm getting off subject, aren't I? So a representative from the University of North Texas came and visited our library and talked to our librarian about that there were funds available to do this. So I met with her, and I'm trying to think of the right word for it, but made a list of all my papers relating to the Harvey Houses of Texas book. And then actually sent the material to the school, and they scanned them and then returned the materials back to me.
So they could archive them.
Yes.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yes, and I am just so thrilled because I had handwritten letters, and I think there are a couple in the book, but I loved that I had the handwriting of these Harvey girls. Mm-hmm. And so this way, it's online for their families or anyone else doing related research. So I'm very, very pleased that that happened.
That's fascinating. Was there anything in your research that surprised you? You know, anything that was like, wow, you know, wow, that's so interesting.
Well, I can't think of anything when I was researching for the books. And this is a question, actually, I think Jim asked early on, and I never answered it. The biggest surprise to me relating to Harvey Houses and Harvey Girls was when I learned that my grandmother had been a Harvey girl in New Mexico. And the reason this was such a surprise is because I didn't know my grandmother. I had been adopted when I was a very young child. And when I found this out, an uncle sent me our family history. And I had no idea what a Harvey girl was. So as I began to learn about my grandmother, I learned about Harvey girls. Mm-hmm. And there were lots of surprises then. I learned that my grandmother was a nurse in Philadelphia and decided that she wanted to work her way to Alaska and applied to be a Harvey girl so that she could work her way along the railroad and get closer at least to Alaska. And then my grandfather was a whaler from the island of Mauritius, and he had gotten off a whaling ship in Veracruz, Mexico, and was walking to California. And my grandmother had passed the interview process in Kansas City and was in Raton, New Mexico. And my grandfather stopped there and went to work for the Santa Fe to make enough money to go on to California. And they married 3 months later and lived the rest of their lives in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
It's such a great story. Their story. I remember reading that in the book and thinking, oh, what a family history. Talk about.
Isn't that great?
Oh,
yes,
my gosh. It's off
it.
A whaling ship. And, you know?
I personally liked all the stories of the girls that they're not supposed to be hanging out with any of the railroad guys.
Yes,
and they all wind up marrying each other.
Yes. Yes. Well,
I know.
Anyway,
I think I said in the Kansas book, Jim, that there was a rule that you couldn't date, but
right.
I guess it was okay to marry.
Right. Exactly. You did say that. Yes.
The manager often conducted the wedding in the Harvey Act.
I love it.
Well, you know, yeah. I think the role of the Harvey girl is so iconic because she was also out front and she right. had a particular. But reading the books and understanding about what's going on in the kitchen and the men mm-hmm. and the pastry boys and the chefs and some of these chefs coming from Europe. And it's like, okay, yeah. now we want to know more about the
right.
Harvey guys, you know,
yeah.
like what's really going on in that kitchen? And these recipes, you give us some recipes in the back of the
yeah.
book that are
yeah,
so
yeah,
fun.
Yeah.
Because their story is beginning to be told here, but
yes.
they would sight unseen.
Right, right. And you yeah. get all these knife-wielding yeah. German guys that
yeah,
are
you know,
in the
just...
kitchens, and they're chasing these people out of the kitchens with these butcher knives. And
Well, and that is a pervading story, is how mean the chefs were. And, you know, you just wonder if they were really mean or because their English was broken or they just had to talk loud because of the pots and pans. But, yeah, and there's, which, Bobby, you would have read in your book, there's at the Slayton, Texas Harvey House, which they've restored and it's still open. It's a bed and breakfast now. And the Harvey girls there thought that the chef was brewing beer in his bathtub. And then there was another location where actually the chef did brew beer in
that
his bathtub.
That was in Kansas.
It was in Kansas, and
yeah.
the smell was
yeah, it made him stop it because
into the restaurant.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Hey, we're going to be running out of time here in just a minute, Rosa, and I really hate to cut you off, because this is such a fascinating, fascinating story. Why don't you tell our listeners where they can contact you, if you would, please?
Oh, sure. At my website, which is rosalatimer.com, and the books are available there. Which, if you order on my website, of course, I'll sign the book and inscribe it if you want me to. It's also available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and of course, the History Press has a website,
right?
HistoryPress.net, actually, so you can order it there also. But if anyone has Harvey girl stories or Harvey employee stories, I would love to hear them. And you can contact me through my website. And I'm working my way to California.
Yeah.
I hope to do a book in California.
I think you should.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're kind of like the forgotten bastard child out here in California.
Well, some of the Harvey hotels in California were wonderful
yes.
and very luxurious. So
a lot of them were everywhere.
That story told too. Yes,
they were. I mean, some of the ones in Kansas were opulent.
Oh yes,
and
yes.
I mean opulent. It's just the descriptions that you give are just like, wow, I'd like to stay there.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you would. Now, and I don't believe there's any in California. But the La Posada in Winslow, Arizona, has been restored, and it's the way it was in the 30s, and that was the last Mary Colton hotel.
Mm. Okay.
That was the last hotel that she designed, and it's wonderful to stay there. They've really done a good job of recapturing that feeling.
Well, I mean, I'm going to Arizona this weekend.
Are you?
No, next weekend.
Next weekend?
Yeah, my son's a chef, and he chases people in the kitchen with a knife.
Let's see, standing on a corner in Winslow,
Arizona.
Such a quiet night.
That's right. You can do that. You sure can.
It's a girl,
and
my lord, and a black pin Ford.
Yeah, they even have a flatbed truck there.
There you go.
Yeah.
Gotta love it. Well, Rosa, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh,
such fun to have you with us.
And I hope you weren't too bothered by us.
Oh, I love talking with you, and I love that you'd read the books. Thank you much.
Oh, and you will have a Writer's Block coffee mug coming your way.
Oh, wonderful.
It's a great mug. And as soon as you get it, if you would, take a picture of it and shoot it over and put it on our Facebook page.
Facebook page.
And we love that.
I will do that.
We love that.
I will do that. And, all right. Well, and, thank you very much.
And get a hold of the bookie. Book another time where we can talk about your Arizona book and more about the Harvey girls. I mean, Jerry, we're absolutely happy to book you back in July or August or sometime towards the end of the year. If you do that, that would be wonderful.
I will do that, and I'll look forward to talking to you
again. Us too, and thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Good evening.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Wow.
That's so fun.
Rosa Walston Latimer.
It's like we need them still.
You we
know?
Do.
We need them still. Come back, Fred Harvey.
Well, while we're waiting for Gary to call in, let's give him a real quick lowdown on the Cowboy Festival.
Oh, yes. We have the Santa Clarita Cowboy Festival is right around the corner. We kick it off with the Out West Concert Series a Wednesday night, April 19th, with two amazing storytellers, Joe Harrington, who's been a guest on our show, and Mary Kay, and the award-winning singer-songwriter who's traveling in from Utah to be with us that one night. Then we will be out on the grounds of the festival at in a big, big, big booth next to Hart Hall. We'll have about 18 authors with us on Saturday, April 22nd, and Sunday, April 23rd.
This is Gary.
Okay, and we will be having live music and short author presentations throughout the day, both of those days.
Okay, so. And we have a caller coming in.
All right.
Is this you? Mr. Goldstein.
I think so.
Okay. Hi, Gary. How are you?
Hey, good, Jim. How are you?
I'm finer than frog's hair.
Oh, gosh.
I have nothing to say.
Oh, my goodness.
Feel free to use that.
Welcome to the writer's block.
Welcome to the writer's block, Gary. You wanted to talk about a new play that you got opening up, the next week?
I did. It opens March 16th.
Okay.
At Theater 40 in Beverly Hills. It's called April, May, and June.
Okay.
And it's a dramedy about three sisters named April, May, and June. Three women in their 40s, each a year apart, and they convene at their late mother's house to finish cleaning out the end of her things.
Uh-huh.
And in the process, they uncover something about the mother that completely upends their entire 40-some-odd years of thoughts about who this person was, kind of realize they didn't quite know her the way they thought she did. In the process, kind of heal their relationships with each other as sisters and with the memory of the mother.
Mm-hmm.
So it's both funny and touching, and I think people will find a lot to relate to it.
That word, I believe, would be poignant.
Poignant, that's the poignancy, yes. Poignant? There's humor. You know, like they say, you'll laugh, you'll cry, you know.
Okay. Poignant is good. Where is it being produced?
It's at Theater 40 in Beverly Hills.
Okay, old theater. Okay.
Which is a great theater theater and theater company that's been there a long time.
A long time. Beverly Hills High School campus, right?
Yeah, it's on the campus of Beverly Hills High School, and this is the fifth out of their six plays of their 16-17 season.
Wow.
So I was really proud to be selected, and I've got a wonderful director, a great cast, and very exciting.
What, as a playwright, tell us a little bit about, we always love to hear a little bit about process. How did you, have you been working on this a long time? How did you come up with the idea?
Yeah, sure. I wrote it a couple of years ago, maybe about 2.5 years ago, wrote the first draft then, and worked on it over the course of time, and ultimately through my director, submitted it last year, last April, I think, to Theater 40. But the way the play came about, I've written a lot of stage plays, and often they come about because of character. You know, they're about people I want to write about with voices that I'm interested in, which is something that you don't always have the full freedom to do when you write a screenplay or a teleplay. You know, and I've written many of those. So I just was thinking of the words of the title of April, May, and June, and I just thought, what a great title for something. I don't know what, but for something. And then I said, well, I don't know, maybe there's a stage play in there. And then I said, well, who are April, May, and June, or what is April, May, and June? And then I thought about, well, what if they were sisters, and what if they were as close in age as the months themselves, basically, you know, just basically a year apart. And the story just kind of evolved from there. It's all sort of like, where do you put these characters where it's most interesting, where there's the most conflict, the most potential humor or poignancy or whatever. And you know, it sort of went from there. So it was this one was an interesting process for me. Mm-hmm.
Set in contemporary times, it sounds like.
It's set on Long Island in a house on Long Island today. Mm-hmm. Maybe not today. Today is.
right.
On Thursday.
Can
March.
You tell us, present day.
Tell us a little bit about your cast.
There are three really wonderful actresses, Meredith Thomas and Jennifer Lee Locks, L-A-K-S, and Jennifer Taub. Both Jennifers are members of the Theater 40 company, and Meredith is an actress who's actually, she's not with the company, but she's worked at Theater 40 before, and she's somebody I've worked with several times in the past. She's a really terrific actress. We're in rehearsals now. They're doing a phenomenal job. I have a wonderful director named Terry Hanauer, it's going very well.
Cool. Now, where can they get tickets?
Tickets go on sale on March 6th, which is Monday.
Okay.
They can be bought through the Theater 40 website, which is www.theater40.org, and that's theatre.org. They can be bought there starting on Monday, and we open March 16th and play for 5 weeks through April 16th.
Oh, wow. Wow. So it's Beverly Hills Theater 40, opens March 16th. It's called April, May, and June, written by, of course, you, Mr. Gary Goldstein. Tickets go on sale the 6th. And anything else that you want to let us know about real quick, other than the fact that you're on the 29th of June again?
Yes, I'm really looking forward to that. We can talk at full length about screenwriting and TV movie writing and screenwriting versus playwriting and all that good stuff.
I'm
really looking forward to that. Yeah, and I just hope you guys will come and see the play and your listeners, and a good time will be had by all. I promise that.
Excellent. Thank you so much for calling in, Gary.
All right.
Okay. Have a great evening.
Have a great night.
You too.
You bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. Thank you.
That sounds like a really fun show, entertaining show. Entertaining show, yeah.
Entertaining. Beverly Hills Theater 40, March 16th.
That's a great little theater. I shouldn't say little theater. That's a great theater.
My mom went to high school there.
And we used to go to a car show every year there on the grounds. But I went to see a play there a couple of years ago. The guest had been with us on Around the Barn, I think. Anyway, and didn't know about that theater and how long. They have a really long history, and we saw a marvelous production.
Yeah,
so
it's been there a long time.
Kind of have it be back on my screen again.
Okay, well, I'm glad to see it back on your screen again. Then. By golly! So anyway, back to the Cowboy Festival. That is April 22nd, 23rd.
Right, and you can get full information about ticketing and everything for the festival. Very simple at cowboyfestival.org.
Right,
it is .org. O-R-G.
Right, it is org. And tickets, I believe. Run $10?
I think it's $10 gets you admission to the festival.
Right.
There are some separate ticketed events that happen on Main Street in two of the theaters, but everything on the main grounds of the William S. Hart Park is all included in your ticket.
Right.
So you can come see us with your ticketed admission on both days from 10 to 6, with performances starting at 10:30.
Right. Some of the feature writers we'll have there will be Richard Polinelli, the twins, the Heisner boys, Eric Heisner and Al Bringus, I believe Dale Jackson, J.R. Sanders,
Cheryl Rogers Barnett, the daughter of Roy and Dale. Of course, Jim Christina, our host of this show, Courtney Joyner will be with us, Andrea Kidd, who's been a guest on the show, Katie Ryan, who's finishing up a documentary on Don Edwards.
I love Katie Ryan.
And who's also
so
a writer. J.R. Sanders is back. Peter Schreiko, Janet Squires, and Margaret Brownlee return this year.
Yay.
We're just so happy to have them with us. Bob
Both
Brill,
have been on the show.
Bob Brill, who is also a local radio personality and a
KNX.
And a writer. Then we'll have Almeda Bradshaw. She's a singer, songwriter, performer. Wonderful. You'll enjoy her, and she'll be both performing as well as being there with all of our authors. We've got a really great lineup.
We do. And if you don't want to come and visit the folks in the writer block, at least go to the show for the peach cobbler.
Yeah, it's such a fabulous experience, and it is top talent in the Western genre that you and the family will really enjoy.
They have the best coffee, and they have the best peach
cobbler. Really good food, wonderful. Joey Dillon, who's a
gun twirler,
yeah. Very entertaining. We've got trick ropers. We've got vendors. There will be vendors that come in from all over the West with everything you can imagine. And it's just really fun in a beautiful. There's this year Civil War reenactors again.
Right.
There's a whole area for kids. There's Native American dancers. It's really a celebration of
the West.
Music, poetry, and history and culture of the West.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us again on this wonderful Thursday evening here at the Writer's Block. And we'll be back next week when our guest is, Reggie Padden.
There we go.
Dr. Reggie Padden, and he's written a book called Get Out of the Dumpster.
Oh, I need that.
And I can hardly wait to get into it. I started it this morning, and it seems like a fabulous read so far. So we'll be talking to Reggie next week. And, of course, we're always here on Thursday nights right here on LA Talk Radio.